Hi, this is Eric Schlein of the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today's episode of the Intelligent Investing Podcast is sponsored by Red Rock Running. Runners and joggers out there, tell me if this sounds familiar. You go into your local running store to pick up some gear, first the shirt, and as you browse the shirts, you see that nice, high-quality performance shirt running you at least $40. Then, you need something to carry your smartphone so you can listen to the Intelligent Investing Podcast while you run. Or maybe you want to track your run with a GPS. A smartphone carrier costs something like $20 or $30. And between work, family, and other responsibilities, the only chance many of us have to go for a run is early in the morning or late at night. That often means running in the dark. So, to help stay safe, you need a reflective vest to increase visibility. That's another $10, $15. So, in total, you can expect to spend over $100 just for gear that goes on your upper body. Red Rock Running has a better way. Their new Bryce running shirt combines all three of those products into one simple item. Secure pockets built directly into each sleeve carry your smartphone or other audio device, a couple of keys, headphones, or energy gels. Strategically placed, reflective material increases your visibility, keeping you safe when running in the dark. Intelligent Investing Podcast listeners know the importance of value. Purchasing a technical shirt, smartphone carrier, and a reflective vest separately costs over $100. The Bryce running shirt, however, gives you all three for only $59. And Red Rock Running is offering listeners this podcast an additional 15% off any purchase by using the promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So that's right, listeners, if you are a listener of the Intelligent Investing Podcast, you get an additional 15% off any purchase of a shirt that's already a good value by using that promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So remember, go to Red Rock Running, REDROCK, running.com, and receive 15% off your Bryce running shirt with promo code INVESTINGPOD, INVESTINGPOD. Carry more, increase visibility, decrease hassle.
Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
Hi, this is Eric Schlein. You're listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. We have a very special show for you guys today. We are at Murphy's Tap Room in Manchester, New Hampshire, with the one and only Dan McGuire of Two Coast Capital Partners, who is a partner, founding partner at Two Coast Capital. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you very much, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, it's very interesting to have you on because, you know, we are a show about value investing and you are an angel investor. But what I've always found fascinating about you is that even though you come, you have an investment approach that is angel investing, which isn't, you know, your typical approach in the value investing world, you come from it from a very rational framework, and that's why I wanted to have you on the show.
Okay. Yeah, but you have to realize that even an angel investor, angel investing is not 100% of what they do, or for most people, it's 10% or something like that. So people do rationalize what they do by saying, well, I could lose that 10% and nothing's going to happen to me, sort of.
Interesting. So how did you get started with all this?
Basically, I'm a computer engineer, and I was working at a company in Santa Clara, California. And one of my coworkers was leaving the company to start his own company with his wife and his brother. And, you know, I sent him an email, and I said, I'm sorry to see you go, and is there anything I could do to help you? Let me know. You know, just a casual email. And he came back to me and he said, yeah, well, you know, we could use some money. So he came over, he and his wife came over to my house and they told us what they were planning to do. And he says to me, well, you know, my parents are putting in $100,000 and her parents are putting in $100,000. What would you like to... And I'm thinking to myself, oh, $100,000. You know, so I said, well, you know, how about $50,000? Which was, you know, it was both the best and the worst investment decision I ever made in my life, because it should have been $100,000 because they were super, super successful. So the first lesson of angel investing is do great on your very first one, because that lets you get to all the rest. And so they this company that they started is called Marvell Semiconductor, and it's now it's a public company, MRVL. And it was super, super successful, even though, looking back on it, the deal that I got was not a was not good enough for me to invest today. But what I knew then was nothing, and so it just worked out. So.
Interesting. And what had you want to put the money in the first place? You know, from the framework that you were coming from back then, what appealed to you about the investment?
Well, this guy. So I knew him.
Yeah.
I knew that he was a very competent engineer, and so he told me the particular product that they were working on, and also the skills of his brother and his wife, and they were sort of complementary, and the product that they were their original plan was to make sort of a simple product to it's a fabless semiconductor company, so they're making chips, and so they were going to make a chip for a certain use, and which seemed reasonable, and but then they were planning on making some money out of that and hiring more people and then going on to a much, much bigger market type of chip. And so all of that sounded reasonable. The brother was going to be the chief technical officer. He had a lot of experience. He had worked for both of them have PhDs. They worked in that field and so on. And I knew this guy because I'd worked with him for years, and I knew he was very, very competent. So all that, and that's when you're investing in a startup, the quality of the people is I would say sort of the most important thing, because you know the best laid plans of mice and men don't come through. Things change. Things happen. Your plan doesn't go forward. But if you have good people, they can react and
course correct
and so on. So that the people involved is very, very important.
So that leads literally to the next question I was going to ask you, where I was going to ask you how much does the human factor play into it in terms of what you look for in management? Obviously a lot. What do you look for in a management team that you're going to be investing in?
Well, I think I look for, first of all, in this case, it was easy to evaluate because I knew the person I worked with him.
Yeah.
But in most cases, it's not so easy. So you're looking for any kind of references that you might find from other people that they've worked with, good experiences that they've had. Had they had a successful startup before or some other similar business experience? And it's not easy. That's a difficult one when you're meeting a stranger, and you have to just sort of get comfortable with them to some extent.
And are typically your investments made where you're betting on an individual person, or are you betting on a team?
It's often they come with two or three people, something like that. It's not. Typically just one person. It's somebody that's they've already been working on this privately with a couple of other people. But often it's something where they want this investment because they're trying to get to the next level, which is like hiring another five people or something of that sort. So they kind of have an idea for a product. They often have a prototype product, but they need to get to the next level, which is actually producing it in volume.
Right. So someone who's, still an active angel investor, when you're coming across a potential deal, how do you find these potential deals? Do they come to you? Do you come to them? What does that look like?
In my case, I'm involved in angel investing groups. And so, that one was unusual. Again, it was somebody I worked with. And that's happened a couple of times. But most of the time, it's because I'm involved in an angel investing group. And so entrepreneurs can find these groups by web searching or whatever. And then they put in sort of applications or just the business plans. And that's how we, and we have a filtering process. So, you know, we end up actually meeting, you know, some small percentage of those who apply with us.
So what's the initial checklist look like and how you filter people out?
Well, I'm not too involved in that myself, but it's a matter of, you know, is this a serious effort? Is it somebody who really knows their business or doesn't? Is the potential there? Because typically we're looking for some kind of a business that has the potential to be a multiple times return. So it's something that, it's not something where, I don't know, you're making, pick something, gravel, you know, and you just want to buy a gravel pit and you know gravel sells for you know, $20 a yard or something, and it's not going to be any different than the next guy's gravel, right? So it's something where often there's a patents involved, there's some new kind of technology, some brand new idea that has a potential for really changing their market or doing very well.
So can you talk about an investment you made that was successful that came through that means?
From a group?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, in fact, I'll tell you the one most recent one. When I first started doing this, I lived in California. Subsequently, I lived in Washington State, and now I live in New Hampshire. And we moved to New Hampshire 11 and a half years ago. And the very first investment that we made in New Hampshire, or just after moving here, it was actually in Massachusetts, was a company called EOS, which is located on Cape Cod. And just a week ago, I received the check from that investment. So finally, after like 11 years, that investment paid off, and it was pretty good. It was 4 or 5 times what we invested. So, you know, we were quite happy.
Pretty good for a decade, yeah.
You know, it's not bad.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, that was the very, you know, and I've had, you know, we invest in, say, 2 companies a year or something like that. So since being here, we've invested in, call it 20 companies. And, but it was interesting because that one was the very first one. So,
and what did you find appealing about that investment? What do they do?
That company makes a product for municipal septic, municipal wastewater treatment plants.
Okay.
And what they do is help them remove things, make their effluent, the stuff that they put out into the river, less toxic or less, you know, environmentally damaging. And in particular, their product is had 2 big advantages. Number one, it was created from farm waste. So things like, I don't know, corn husks or whatever, things that are byproducts of farming. Okay, so raw inputs were cheap, right? And then secondly, the product that they created that they, you know, people dump into the process of the municipal wastewater, itself was non-toxic and in particular non-flammable because what they're competing with, what's normally used in the process, was methanol. Okay, so it's flammable and dangerous.
Yeah.
And there have been cases where people have been killed because of explosions in wastewater treatment plants. Right. You know, so you know that's. You know, it was relatively easy for them to compete with that, right? Because you're talking about a product that's safe, and then secondly, it does what they wanted. Secondly, the regulations involved, over time it gets stricter and stricter what they're allowed to dump into rivers, And so more and more people were going to need this particular step in their wastewater treatment plant. So, you know, overall, there was a very good story about this product is an improvement on what exists, and it it's going to be needed more and more over time.
And they came to you guys in an angel investing group?
Yes, right. So, it was a group that has since sort of defunct. It was started by a guy named Mort Gulder, who was since deceased, but he's was a fantastic long-term angel investor in New Hampshire. He helped start Sanders Associates, which is, you know, eventually become, what's this company? It went to Lockheed, and then it's, what is it? It's this British company. Now, in defense.
No.
You don't know. Anyways. But the company is, he himself started many, many companies and it was very, very successful. And so I got into his angel investing group, which happened to be called the Breakfast Club, because we always met with entrepreneurs over breakfast at Denny's. That shows you how cheap we are in New Hampshire. But anyways, and so you know, that's when they would give us their pitch and all that. And so this particular one was interesting, and we invested in it. And it was, you know, why did it take 11 years? It's because the municipal wastewater treatment business is not very quick. You know, it's government. And it's not particularly innovative, right? So even though the regulations were starting to come along, this is something new, so you had to prove it, and so on. But so it took a while for them to get going, but eventually it worked out.
So it was a compelling story. So one of the things, I hit the table like this, and it makes a sound. So Dan was being very kind, letting me know my elbow. See, I don't have an official producer, so I have other people, my guests, be my producer. So I don't have to think about it. Thank you, Dan.
You're welcome.
Dan McGuire, the official producer of episode 8. So, Mr. Producer, question. When that company came to you, was there any kind of wondering, okay, well, are there other companies that might be able to do this? What made that company so special, right? Because if I see this trend, why can't 10 other people start a similar company? Do they have some kind of patent, or, you know?
Yeah, I think in this case there was a patent on the process that produced what they were going to produce. So they had a chemist who was at the root of it, and he had a patent about creating this particular product for this particular use.
Yeah. So. And then when these governments hire the company, right? Because it's governments that are hiring the company to clean.
Well, they're doing is buying the stuff.
Right.
The stuff that gets dumped into the water at a certain point in the process.
Right. So did you see an advantage of basically the government being a customer?
Not particularly.
No.
I mean, it's just, that's, and actually there are some private water treatment facilities.
Okay.
If you have something like a condo complex or a very large apartment building or whatever, they may have their own, and so that might be part of it too. So not every customer was government, but it, you know, it tends to be you know, municipals, you know,
I would imagine they'd be a more stable, reliable customer. Is that true or not really?
I don't think so. I mean, in general, any large building or industrial facility is going to use water, and some use it to one more extent or lower,
right, yeah.
And you know, so on. So, it's just that was the business that happened to be in.
Now, right? If they did not have a patent, would you have still invested?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, if they had some story about why it'd be hard for others to come into this business, mm-hmm. As opposed to, well, everybody knows you could do this and nobody's doing it now or something like that, you
right.
know, that would be less attractive.
Have you invested in some kind of, you know, some kind of company that didn't have a patent, but was doing something innovative that you did feel had some kind of competitive moat?
Sure. I invested in a company that helps readers find Kindle-type books, okay? And so it's basically a marketing kind of company, and they're a go-between between a set of readers and publishers. And so, and primarily for women, this is in the romance novel space. And so this particular company, what they do is they've gotten over time these giant lists of readers. And so authors will come to them and say, and pay them a little bit to push their book, right? And they make a discount this week or a free book or whatever. And so it gets their book in front of a lot of people.
And then where would they get the list from?
It's just they people find them from web searches. They advertise in places where on Amazon, on the right pages and things like that. And just over time, they build it up, or word of mouth or all that. So
interesting.
So it's just like a website. Think of it that, right? But what they do is market these romance novels over Kindle romance novel, or Nook or whatever, those kind of books.
How long ago was that investment?
That one is still going on. I think we probably invested about 2 or 3 years ago. And that one was a little different because it actually had come to my angel group maybe 2 years before that, and I had declined to invest. Okay.
And why was that?
And just because to me, what I just told you seemed like part of what we were talking about. Right. There's nothing unique about that, right? Why can't anybody do that?
Yeah.
And so I didn't invest. And others did. A lot of money some amount of money went into it, and it flopped. Okay. And then the second time around, they came back to us for more money, and they had a new person at the helm of it. And it was so cheap that, so what had been a valuation of a few million became a few hundred thousand. Okay.
Yeah.
So the second time around, they said, this is so cheap, and we have a new guy, have new enthusiasm and so on. And so far, it seems pretty good. I mean, they've had further rounds of going the right way, namely increasing. And the number of authors is increasing, the number of readers is increasing, all that sort of thing. So so it's just that one was more a matter of the price seemed wrong at the first, and then it was much better. So,
or maybe pricing wrong compared to how they actually did at the beginning, right? Because if they'd done incredible, then maybe it was an appropriate price.
Yes, right. But whenever you're looking at an investment like this, you got to try to gauge what's the possible gain and the likelihood of gain compared to what you're paying for it. And I would, so far it seems like I was certainly right at first not to invest. The question is, was I right to invest the second time? We don't know yet. So,
yeah. What's the company called? Are you able to say?
You're going to ask me that, and I'm, for some reason I'm blanking on the name.
Totally fine. So,
because I don't read I signed up for the service.
Yeah.
And after about 2 weeks, I said, wait a minute, these books aren't for me. Because 95% of the customers are women, right?
Yeah. So it's like. So when you're looking at a company like that, right, are you projecting, are you coming up with different scenarios? If revenue grows by X amount in 10 years, I make this much. Are you doing any kind of calculations like that?
Just very broadly, yes.
It has to be broadly with something.
Right, like that. Yeah. But what you're looking for is, a projection of what you think in 5 years or 10 years or wherever you think the exit might come, what would revenue be like at the time? And frequently when a company like this gets bought out, very small companies, when they get bought out, the buyer will pay some kind of multiple times revenue based on what the business is. And so that could be 3 times or 4 times or 5 times or, you know, something like that. Maybe sometimes a little more. But if the company gets to a point, typically companies will get bought when they have a product in the market, that product is selling, and then they need to take it to the next level, which is take it international, to more states, just to more customers, whatever. That would be the point where the company would get sold, and they would get sold, like I said, for a typical multiple of revenue. So given the business, we say, well, what can revenue be when we get to that point? And that's just a guess, obviously.
And so walk me through with this company. What were you looking at, and what you're thinking around how big the company could get in X amount of years? What was your thinking?
Well, in this kind of case, we look at how many Kindle romance novels get sold.
So that's the key data point.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And so and could we represent 5% of them or something like that, right? I mean, I suppose that was a reasonable number, and then how much revenue could each one generate, and that kind of thing. So that's kind of where it goes. You know, obviously there's, with a business like that, there's potential that it broadens itself to related businesses that are, you know, other kinds of novels. You know, maybe they could get into science fiction or mystery or, you know, whatever. So there's room to grow, but generally you think about that on the side. The main thing you're thinking about is their main business.
Interesting. So what are some of the biggest mistakes that you've made, and what have you learned from them?
I can tell you about my most disappointing investment.
Sure, yeah.
And I'm not sure what I learned from it exactly. It goes back to the people aspect of it. And what was this particular business, it was disappointing mostly because it was one that when I initially invested in it, I thought it was one of the most promising things that I had invested in, you know, so... you know, sometimes when you do this, some look better than others, right?
Yes.
And you have to be careful not to let that color your investment a little too much, because to you think, okay, this is a really good one and that one's not so good, you know, so maybe you put a little more money in one than another, but you can't sort of put, you know, half your portfolio in one. You know, you can't do that kind of thing.
Right.
So anyways, so this particular business, what they were doing was they said there's increasing, again, it was based on environmental regulations. That's just happens to be a coincidence. But this particular company was saying that if you have a small business like a printer or a dry cleaner, or an auto body shop, or whatever, you're getting increasing regulation on you from the fire department, from DES, from everybody, saying you've got to comply with this regulation and that regulation, the other thing. You know, so just from the fire department, when you have chemicals in your business, you've got to have these special sheets on file that say, I'm storing toner number 1234, and if it ever caught on fire, it would produce this noxious gas, and we would have, you could douse it with soda, you know, with baking soda or something, you know, whatever it is, there's some standard data sheet that you need for each kind of chemical. And printers have that, and dry cleaners have that, and so on. And so this company said, what we are going to do is, right now, what are these businesses doing to comply with all that regulation? What they do is they hire individual consultants once a year to come in, look at all their stock, update all their forms, send them off to the fire department, send them off to DES, all that, send them to the feds, and then they're good for another year, right? Yeah. And these consultants are costing them, you know, $500 a year or something to do the thing, right? And the thing is that really one dry cleaner is not that different from another dry cleaner, or one paint store is not that different from another paint store. And so what they were going to do was to basically study how all the forms are needed for the jurisdiction involved and all the common brands of chemicals that are involved, you know, the common paints or dry cleaning materials or what have you, and write a software program like TurboTax or something like that. So when the business bought, I just got a 5 gallons of dry cleaning fluid, brand X, they could type into this piece of software, bought 5 gallons of brand X dry cleaning fluid, and it would spew out all the forms needed for that particular purchase, and they could update their files and so on. So no consultant would be needed. It would be just a piece of software. And so they could afford to do this right for Oregon or Washington or California or whatever, and learn the subtle differences from one place to another. And they could start it with one kind of business, you know, say auto body shops, and get that right, and then go on to dry cleaners, and then go on to, you know. So it was a business that at first was fairly tiny. What they were doing was they were doing print shops in Oregon. Okay? So they knew what did the Oregon fire marshal require, what did the Oregon Department of Environmental Services require, and what are printers buying, you know, what kind of ink, what kind of toner, what kind of this, you know, cleaning fluid and all that sort of stuff. And they had a piece of software and that did all that. And then they had some customers who were print shops, and they were selling the software to them, and they loved it, actually. You know, it was, they were already in business, they were already doing that, and what they wanted to do was they needed some money to hire more people to start to, let's take our software and let's do it for California, you know, let's go for Texas, let's go for New York, let's, you know. And it was easy to see how this business could expand tremendously, right? I mean, they were very small and so on. So I thought this was a fantastic business. And everybody knows these kind of regulations are getting more and more complicated over time. So it's only going to get better over time, right?
Yes.
So overall, I thought this was a fantastic investment. And there were two guys involved. One was the CEO and one was the chemist guy, right, who wrote the software and so on. And they had a plan for what they needed to hire and all this sort of stuff. And they mainly sold it through professional associations. You know, so there's an association of dry cleaners and an association of printers and, yeah, you know, that kind of stuff, who all these small businesses tend to be members of. And so they would advertise in those publications or whatever. So that was their plan. And we invested in it, and like 9 months later, it was all gone. Well, this is what the problem was. And the problem was, believe it or not, and it's not something I at the time thought of, it was our investment that killed them. Okay? And you ask, you know, how's that possible? And yeah, and what happened is when we make an investment as a group, and typically, you know, we end up getting a sizable part of the company, you know, we might get 20% of the company or something like that for our group.
Right.
And we get a seat on the board, right? Now, in this particular case, they didn't have much of a board, and I think we actually got 2 seats on the board. But we made, you know, our group was making a fairly sizable investment. And the problem was that the people from our group who got on their board did not get along with the entrepreneur, okay? So their style of management was not compatible with the entrepreneur's style, okay? And so they clashed. And these people who became like the chairman of the board of this company were putting all kinds of requirements on the entrepreneur to create this report, to do this, to do that. And the guy rebelled at that.
Yeah.
So that was one thing. And so all of a sudden, there was where he was supposed to be working on the product, there was conflict, and he was dealing with this board and these board members that were making things difficult for him. And then on top of that, the guy who was the chemist started to have some personal issues, like divorce-type problems, right? And so that person's productivity and so on declined. And so all of a sudden, we have a company where the two main people running it are having troubles. And basically what I learned, well, what I know, I don't think I learned it on this instance, but the thing about these investments, because these companies are so tiny, they are extremely fragile. And so any one thing can kill it, okay? It's not like, you know, if you wanted to kill GE, you got to have a nuclear bomb go off in their headquarters. You know, and that might not even do it, right? You know, it's tough. It would be very tough for GE to go out of business completely. You know, they could have bad years. They could lose money.
Do a lot of dumb stuff.
A lot of dumb stuff.
Which they have.
But a company this size, any one thing, you know, if the marketing is bad, if the people are bad, if the money is a problem, if somebody gets divorced, any little thing, if they go down the wrong path slightly, you know, any one thing can kill it really easily. And so that's sort of what happened in this case. We put the wrong person on their board, and that just was, you know, crumbled the whole thing. And it was amazing how quickly it was. It was like nine months. And it was so disappointing just because I thought it was a fantastic, I still think it's a fantastic idea, you know. But it's all gone.
It's interesting, right? So I have a personal interest in understanding how, you know, corporate cultures work and how people work together. And last year I was in Virginia, at an annual meeting of a company called Markel Corporation.
Okay.
And the chief investment officer there, who's also, they have two CEOs. It's not a common thing in the public space to have two CEOs, but, you know, they're $10 billion plus insurance company with two CEOs. This guy named Tom Gaynor, who's been there, I think, since 1986. Mm-hmm. And he's also very big into, you know, making sure that people are getting along, and we're not just talking about teamwork, but it's very cohesive. And it's one of those things where if you're in that environment, it's very obvious that there's something very different about how the people interact. And it was interesting because I was talking to one of the VPs at the company, Steve Markel, who's in the Markel family, and I said, you know, it's really cool what you're doing here. It's almost like you have, a downscale Berkshire Hathaway.
Oh.
And he goes, well, no, it's not like that at all, actually. Our culture is a bit better than Berkshire Hathaway. that's a pretty bold statement. He goes, you know, with all these, like, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but obviously these guys are lovers of Buffett and lovers of that model and have certainly copied a lot of that model. But what they said, you know, the big difference between them and Berkshire, they said, look, if you go to a Dairy Queen, right, which is owned by Berkshire Hathaway, the high school person with the cash register is not going to be ingrained in the Berkshire Hathaway culture. It's like I work at Dairy Queen, right? But what was interesting, they said, you know, at Markel, any of their acquisitions that they make, no matter how small, because they're very entrepreneurial with how they work, and they have something called Markel Ventures, which is like almost like their private equity arm, right?
Mm-hmm.
Any acquisitions they make, the first criteria before they even care about the price or anything is, do you fit into the way we operate culturally already?
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how they get along with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And where I really noticed this was, and Steve Markel goes, you know, go talk to our employees. We have 900 of them here today. I'm sitting at a table, and this guy comes up to me, and I go, oh, so do you work at Markel? He's like, I do. He goes, what do you do? He goes, I work in IT, right?
Okay, sure.
And you having, you know, a computer background, you know that sometimes IT departments can be separated from a lot of the other company, right?
Sure.
And I said, you know, how do you like working here? And he goes, I love it. And I go, how long have you been working here for?
Mm-hmm.
He goes, about, it was like 6 or 9 months. I said, oh, so you're new. He goes, well, I came in from the acquisition of another company.
I see.
And I said, "Oh, what was that transition like for you?" He goes, "I don't even notice, because even though Markel has their own culture, the culture of our company is basically the same. We don't word it the same way, but it was basically the same. That you didn't even notice, and we get along with everyone, and it's great." And I was like, the IT person is telling me about the corporate, like, this is pretty cool. So, and you know, Tom Gaynor has shared with me in Virginia that, you know, one of the reasons they do this is to prevent, you know, screwing something up with people clashing. So I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah.
So any other would you say key mess ups that you've had in your career that were like big learning moments for you? I think that's interesting that you say that, where a lot of people don't think about with, you know, buying these tiny companies, how any one thing could really screw something up.
Yeah. And I don't know. I guess maybe just in some cases being enamored of the business itself and downplaying what possible negatives, things that don't seem quite right. You know, it's you really have to, in this business, you have to say no
like
9 times out of
yeah.
10, right? And a lot. And, you know, that's true. In some sense, that's true of all investing.
I was just going
right?
to say, yeah.
Right? In all investing, you look at a stock and you might spend a whole day looking at it or something, and then you say, I think I'll pass.
Yeah. Well, like I say in my industry, it's like we have, you know, there's the too expensive.
Right.
There's the things that seem cheap. Right. Then there's the no-brainers,
right.
And then there's the too hard pile, and most things go on the too hard pile. I just, you know, it's not a no-brainer, but maybe it's expensive. I don't know, so I'm just I don't have to swing.
Right, and so so it's tough sometimes, because sometimes the product or whatever just seems extremely attractive. And one thing that I like a lot is one where there's a good track record, especially where if there's a track record with me, you know, the person in the past has made me money with another business, and sometimes will invest in their follow-on business.
Yeah.
And then there's also just where the business itself is so large that you figure there's got to be a place to make money in this particular business. This most recent one that I'm about to make an investment in is of that sort.
Okay.
And so it's not one where, it's one where I haven't spent a lot of time myself investigating the business and the people. That somebody else in my group has done that. Who I think is, you know, I think that person is
a good track record
and so on. Right. But the business is so large that if they're able to make the product, which seems to be already proven, they've already gotten, you know, I can talk about what it is if you want to know, but that's a big plus for what, in my mind. And it's just that there have been a few instances where there have been hints that something is not quite right, But I've sort of ignored those and not been happy with
the
results.
Like dating someone and seeing the red flag.
Yeah.
Well, she's so pretty.
Right.
The product is so great.
Yeah, maybe something. Like that.
So I want to ask you more about avoiding, you know, things to avoid, right? So
okay.
Charlie Munger at Berkshire Hathaway uses this concept called inversion,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, he says if you want to be happy, instead of seeking what to do in order to be happy, avoid things that will not make you happy, right? And he jokes around. He goes, you know, if I knew where I was going to die, you know, I wish I knew I was going to die, because I would never go there.
Right.
So, and then, you know, Buffett says, rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, don't forget rule number one.
Right.
So a lot of what I'm hearing, right, is, you know, it's obviously great. You know, a lot of things are great products. As you know, CEOs are often master salespeople, and they can make anything sound nice. What are, just from your history of doing this, some of the things to look for that, you know, you want to actually avoid first?
Sure. Well, if the things that we just, and this is, first of all, there's just general things that our group avoids,
yeah,
that it's not hard to do, but basically, if the entrepreneur themselves is way too green to see the problems involved, right?
Yeah.
So you ask them questions, and if they never thought of that issue that you ask about, if they seem to brush it off when we think it's a more serious issue,
they turn it positive every time, basically.
Yeah, or
not
just
really a big deal anyway. Yeah,
right. That kind of thing. If they seem too inexperienced and haven't thought out all the little corner cases and things
right.
like that. But on the other hand, when you ask questions and they have a lot of detail about each of the things, clearly they've thought of everything that you can think of.
Yeah.
Then that's a very good sign, I think. So, so that's one thing. Is just you end up seeing people that it's clear they're inexperienced.
Right.
Other cases where sometimes they might be a little too dependent on one particular customer or one very big customer or something like that. There's one we invested in not too long ago, maybe a few years ago, that's having trouble, and they seem to have trouble diversifying away from just the one customer that they've got, and selling more customers, you know, something that should be able to sell
right.
to many customers, but it's they're having trouble with that, and there was probably some signs of that early on that I didn't pay attention to.
Do you look at all for things in terms of the way? So a lot of entrepreneurs that I know. Right, they're so hyped up about their product, which is great, right? To like
mm-hmm.
your product, but sometimes they're too in love with their product. They don't see, they haven't thought about the
yeah.
bad stuff. Have you? Something
yes.
that I've seen is entrepreneurs, because everyone makes mistakes. It's
mm-hmm.
if you're in business, part of the game, you're going to make mistakes. And something that you know Buffett does, and something that I've tried to model, is that when there's a mistake that's made, you own up to it immediately, and you're just straight with
yeah.
it. Have you seen, I don't know how you gauge it at the beginning, but people where they tend to not really own up to their mistakes or get kind of weird about it?
Yeah.
Right? Because everyone, I'm going to imagine it, every business you've invested in, it's somewhere along the way, there's some mistake, something that's a little shaky, and you have to correct course.
Mm-hmm.
And do you look at the way that people actually handle that when it happens?
Yes. Yes, although the problem is it's too late at that point.
Right. So are there things you can...
Well, except, you know, I'll tell you this. Almost every business we invest in goes for further rounds. So you're investing in a particular round of investments,
right.
but they're going to need more money later before they get bought out, right, or go public.
Sure.
And so I'm... Just in general, one general thing for me is I hardly ever invest in a subsequent round. And my reasoning is, which is unusual, most people, they start with a little, and then later on they invest a little more and a little more and so on. And you can be successful both ways.
Yeah.
But my reasoning is, if things are going well, then the price I paid originally is much lower than the price I'm asked to pay the second time, and the price I'm, you know, so my ability to get more share sort of it declines over time, right? Because
right.
unless I want to put in a lot more money the second time than I did the first, and so on, which I in this business, we want to diversify as much as possible, right?
Right.
You know, if I have put $50,000 into something, and now another opportunity comes along, I'd rather look for something that seems as about as good to put another $50,000 in that new thing. So now I have two chances for doing well, as opposed to, well, I'll put another $50,000 into this because it's going great, you know. Because my second $50,000 into this only buys me as much as $25,000 originally would have bought.
So
right?
this is really interesting, and I'm very curious now. I've never even thought about this.
Right.
But So the reason that investors would pay up in the further rounds is there's less uncertainty.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah, yeah. And maybe it's the same way in the markets you deal with, but in public markets, right? So there's a book called The Dondo Investor by Monish Pabrai, and he coined this term low risk, high uncertainty. Now, obviously, what you're doing, I would call low risk, right? You need to diversify. But he talks about uncertainty as something to actually embrace. Where a lot of investors in public markets, they see uncertainty and they want to sell at any price and they get really scared. And sometimes there's actually a lot of opportunity. And that doesn't mean if something's uncertain, it's opportunity. But often opportunity happens to coincide with uncertainty. And then when I've seen people, it was amazing. Last year I was in Detroit, right? And I was looking at real estate. I was trying to start a real estate fund. And my thinking was, okay, I'm in Detroit. There's this new stadium being built, city's recovering, but let's say it doesn't, right? So there's uncertainty, right? There's all these possible scenarios. Mm-hmm. Yet I'm finding buildings, right, with 10 to 12% cap rates selling below, well below replacement costs, pennies mm-hmm. on the dollar replacement costs. Mm-hmm. It would have been really hard to lose money on some of these buildings. And furthermore, was able to get, tax write-offs and all this stuff. And everyone that I approached, I didn't actually approach you, but everyone I approached, they said something like, well, it's still a little uncertain. Let's talk about it once the market recovers. I'm like, well, once? That kind of defeats the purpose.
Right.
So I'm wondering, have you found that in your industry, people pay up too much for certainty? It actually becomes a harder game when there's more certainty? Because in public markets, it's absolutely true.
Yeah, it's just that's not my style. So, like I said, I know plenty of successful angel investors who do that, who they like being in every round kind of thing. And sometimes there's some advantages to doing it because they try to make it worthwhile. But again, for me, I don't like being in every. I only like being in the first round that I'm offered. So, and then the second half of that. So one is you're offered another round because things are going well and they need more money. But you can also be offered another round because things are going badly,
right?
And they're about to go out of business or they're about to have they have troubles. Well, do I want to invest in a business that has trouble, right? So it's my logic is let's not be, we've made our decision with this business. Let's look for something else. So
that's really smart.
Yeah.
Essentially, what you're saying is that you're trusting your ability to at least even slightly tilt the odds in your favor that you can gauge when something's going to be successful. So let's say even if you're right,
mm-hmm.
how often would you say you're right? 10% of the time, maybe, that you make something?
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough to generalize,
yeah.
Even though, let's say I've made 30 or 40 of these investments, right? They all have their own unique things, and some have paid off and some haven't,
right.
All that. And my very first one paid off like a rocket ship. So, it was a once in a lifetime type of thing. So, how do you generalize from that kind of a curve? It's not easy. So I don't know. I have a hard time answering that kind of question.
It makes a lot of sense because essentially, if you're going to keep investing in further rounds, what you're essentially saying, and sounds like a dick thing to say, but what you're essentially saying is that you're not really trusting your ability the first time around.
Yes and no. I mean, you have new information,
you're probably going to get a worse deal in the further rounds. Right?
Yes,
so if you're only investing in early rounds, assuming you know what you're doing, you're maximizing the potential that you're getting a better deal.
Yeah. I think so, but again,
I think so. Hey, look, there's investors in public markets that have done well paying up for growth, Right. I don't know many of them, but
right.
there are, right? Yeah. So, you know, it does go both ways.
Yeah.
So let's say someone wants to get into this industry, right? And they're just starting out, maybe they, you know, just retiring and have some extra capital, whatever it is, right? And they want to become an angel investor.
Mm-hmm.
What does the market look like today in this realm, you know, with low interest rates and where the economy is today?
Yeah, I think from what... First of all, again, I can't generalize too much because I only see what I see, but
right.
in our groups. And one thing that was interesting, by the way, so I started doing this on the West Coast, and now I live on the East Coast, right? And there's a style difference between the way people operate on the West Coast and the East Coast that surprised me to some extent, because in some sense... We are more casual on the East Coast than we were on the West Coast.
Huh.
And you would think it would be the opposite. But on the West Coast, we did a lot. We signed a lot of non-disclosure agreements, you know, which is an agreement with a company that says they'll tell you their business as long as you don't tell anybody else about it,
yeah.
right? Whereas on the East Coast, I have never signed a non-disclosure agreement, okay? And so people come and tell us what they're doing, and, you know, they... because it's not, you know, they're really not that necessary because it's not easy. Even if somebody tells you I'm doing this, that, and the other thing, you know, it's a lot of work to do this, that, and the other thing. And so you're not going to turn around the next day and say, you know, well, I'll start
right.
one of those, you know. And so, you know, I don't think they're that useful, but you
buy
know.
I buy a dollar for every
right.
good idea I've ever heard.
Yeah, right.
Very wealthy.
Yeah. So, you know, but... you know, and often there's patents involved,
yeah.
and you don't have those patents and things like that. But, you know, or there's chemists or there's whatever, there's engineers,
right.
and you don't have all that. But anyways, so some of it is there's a different style in the East and the West Coast. But overall, I don't see much change with the change in the economy. There's always people with ideas. There's always people... You know, because the timing of a particular idea happens when the entrepreneur thinks it up.
Yeah.
And that just happens all the time, naturally. And I don't see, it's not much. I don't see much like the economy's going well, so everybody's busy doing whatever they're doing, and they don't have time to think up new ideas. It doesn't really work that way.
Have you found valuations have gone higher in the last few years, or not really?
No, I would say not really.
If say private equity, the larger end, it has gotten quite expensive.
I see. So maybe a little. It's, you know.
So it's very localized.
Yeah, it's localized, and it's valuations tend to be more about how much progress the person has already made, how much money they're going to need to run this business,
yeah.
et cetera. You know, and to some extent, we as angel investors would be a little bit leery of something that looks like too good a deal, you know,
yeah.
that they want to sell us 50% of the company for a very small amount of money or something like that. Because really good really good entrepreneurs don't want to sell equity.
Right.
They want to get money however they can get it, but they want to keep hold of their company because
yeah.
they know that it's a really good company, right?
Yes.
And so so you don't want... If somebody brings you with a deal that seems too good, it's probably not. So,
Interesting.
And we don't want to... You know, and we want the entrepreneur to do well, right? We want the entrepreneur to have a lot of incentive to do
right.
well. So, you know.
Are there any things that you're working on right now that you think are pretty interesting and worth talking about?
Well, I don't know. I can tell you that the latest company idea that I've heard about that I'm planning to invest
yeah.
a fair amount of money in. This one is it's fish food. Okay. So it turns out that
you like investing in products that you don't use, huh?
I eat fish. You know, this
you
is
don't eat the food though.
No.
Joke.
No, but this is for
yeah.
this is big time. This is food for salmon and shrimp and trout and stuff like that,
okay.
which is being farmed. Okay, so this is this is billions of dollars type of business. And it turns out what's being fed to them now is some combination of soy and fish meal, which is ground up anchovies.
Okay.
And this company has developed a one cell organism that creates protein. It's basically protein. And they've bioengineered it to have the 13 amino acids that fish need to grow, okay? So whatever it is, you know, so they have this one-cell organism that that creates stuff that fish can eat, okay? And in a sense, the story is that it replaces fish meal, okay, which is ground-up anchovies, okay? And because the worldwide supply of anchovies is on its edge, right? There aren't any more.
I didn't know that, actually.
Okay, there's a certain number of anchovies out there, and there aren't going to be any more, right? So they, because I don't know what they eat. They eat plankton or something, yeah. Right? And so there's a certain amount of anchovies, and they're being farmed to their limit. And so you can't feed too much soy to fish, because fish are basically carnivores and they need animal protein.
Yeah.
Right? So this product is animal protein for fish, okay? And the interesting thing is that the input to this, what does this single cell organism eat? And that is ethanol. Okay? Huh. So the same stuff that a bushel of corn gets converted to ethanol, that's what these things eat. And so a bushel of corn can essentially be fed to fish.
There's finally used for all these years.
There's a use for ethanol, right? And, you know, the ethanol business itself is kind of stagnant.
Yeah.
Right? And there's many, and it's a huge business, and this would be just a fraction of it and so on. So it's not expected that the input to this business is too expensive, right?
Right.
Now, to grow this fish food in a scale that would make sense would involve a big investment. So, you know, we need to help them get to the point where they can partner with ethanol manufacturers to do this, right? Where you know, those ethanol manufacturers would put in fairly sizable investment. But it's a very interesting business. And again, I like it because it's big, you know, has big potential. So if things go right, it can be a very big return.
Now, is it cheap? So if I am, say, running a salmon farm, mm-hmm. what's my incentive to use this company versus what I'm doing right now?
Well, because it turns out it's actually slightly healthier for your fish. Fewer fish die fed this stuff than the soy the soy combination of with fish meal. So, and plus it'll end up being slightly cheaper than fish meal.
So it actually ends up being cheaper and more fish survive.
And more fish survive. Yes. Yeah. So and you know, in the long run, there's no real limit to how much of this stuff can be produced.
Right.
Where you're at that limit with anchovies. So, you know, there's a reason why salmon and shrimp are $8 a pound in the grocery store and chicken is $1 a pound or whatever it is, right?
Right, yeah.
Because chicken can eat corn and fish can't, you know. And so this is a way of bridging that gap.
And it's interesting, too, where if you look at, I like to eat pastured eggs, right?
Okay.
The difference in price, you can buy it. A 12-pack of eggs for 99 cents
right.
In some places. The cheapest I've ever seen pasture-raised eggs where they're eating, like, worms and, you know, limited supply, maybe the cheapest is $5, and they typically go from, like, say, $6 to $8.
Oh, okay.
So a big price difference.
Yeah.
Exactly. Very interesting.
So hopefully for you guys, if this works out, you will see price of salmon and shrimp and trout and so on come down, and you can enjoy them more often.
Now, is there...
And by the way, I wouldn't minimize doing things like that to benefit people
right.
is part of the attraction of being in this, in the angel investing game, because you do get a feeling that you're making some not big, but I mean some significant sort of human progress.
You're contributing to society.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And that's, even if it didn't make up money, you know, even if I broke even over the long haul, I would still want to do it for that reason. So
so I guess big lesson to potential angel investors out there is you actually have to love this game.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
It helps.
You know, it helps. And a lot of guys that are in this are retired retired executives from whatever business that they were in. So they were CEOs or CFOs or whatever. And so they made a lot of money that way, and that's how they can afford to do this. Because there are limits put on the business by the SEC about, you know, you have to have a certain amount of liquid assets and all that in order to be allowed to be an angel investor. So that's the kind of people you see in this. And so it's people that, you know, otherwise would be playing golf or whatever. And it doesn't take up a huge amount of your time. So, you know, my groups meet once a month. You know, it's not a big deal. But it does keep them in the game, kind of, you know, in a way that just investing in stocks doesn't. So.
Very, very interesting. Would there be, you know, anything else that you think would be worth covering?
Well, I think we've gone on quite some time here, so we'll save up anything else for next time.
Sounds good. And if someone has what they think is a great idea and is looking for capital, is there a way they could contact you or your group or something like that?
Yeah, the main group that I deal with in New Hampshire is called eCoast Angels. So if you went online and you could Google eCoast Angels, and there's a way to send in a business plan and so on. But wherever you are, you could Google your state and angel investing, and you'll find plenty. There's plenty in Boston. There's plenty in wherever you are. So it's not hard to find such a group. It may be a little bit hard to make an impression, but that's the way it is.
Well, Dan, it was a pleasure having you on.
All right.
And thanks for being here. Yes. And for everyone listening, thanks for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, and I hope to see you for the next episode.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.